Okay, I apologize for a little bit of a delay there. There's some technology issues as well as some people we were waiting to show up, and we also wanted to make sure we had the correct amendments before us. So good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order on Monday, March 15th. It started about 1:34 p.m. Today we have with us Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes, Senator Meyer, Senator Keel, and myself, Chairwoman Reinbold. I'd like to remind committee members and those to silence their phones today. And we also have with us our great staff, Nancy Hemingway with records, Alex with the LIO, and Kelly. So we're back to normal. It's great. And so today we have three things actually on the agenda. We have led counsel. We have Megan, and I'm so happy you're here today, Megan. We also have one confirmation that we're waiting. Usually I do the confirmation hearing first, but that was another thing we were waiting for them to call in. We got confirmation that they were calling in today, but they're not called in yet. So, Megan, we're going to go ahead and let you to jump to the front of the line, if that's okay. We're really, really happy that you're with us. I wanted to get you before the committee before we had our big meeting this coming Wednesday. And so, Megan, you look sharp. We're here. And so if you want to go ahead, you know the record. You know what we're supposed to be doing today. We are definitely talking about the alleged legal discussion with the lawsuit and the governor's appointees, which we've been given. You know, we have a lot of appointees in this committee, so that's important. We're also going to be doing the electronic wills, and Senator Myers has some invited testimony and also people here to answer our questions once we get to Senate Bill 90, and then we have one confirmation hearing on the schedule today. But with that, Megan, welcome to Senate Judiciary. Thank you so much for being here. And please proceed when you're ready.
Can you see me on the Teams unit?
Yeah, it looks great. Yep.
Okay, great. I wasn't able to hear you, so I just wanted to make sure you could see me. So for the record, my name is Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. And as you noted, I'm here today to just generally discuss the ongoing and pending lawsuit between legislative counsel on behalf of the legislature and the governor with respect to the governor's appointees that occurred during the regular session last year. So as a little bit of background for those of the public who may not be familiar with the events that took place in 2020, so last year, last March, just before, as the pandemic hit, the legislature was getting ready to go to an extended recess and wasn't able to meet in joint session because of the public health situation, to meet in joint session to confirm the governor's appointees before they went to their extended recess. And so the legislature passed a bill, HB 309, which extended the time by which the legislature could meet in joint session to confirm the governor's appointees. And so the legislature, like I said, extended the time, and the time was extended to 30 days upon expiration of the governor's March disaster declaration. And so the governor's disaster declaration expired on November 15th. So under HB 309, the governor's appointees expired 30 days after that expiration of the disaster declaration. And HB 309 had a provision, and it said that if the legislature was unable to confirm that those appointments would be tantamount to declination. So after expiration, 30 days after expiration of the March disaster declaration, the governor issued a letter to the presiding officer stating that he was going to extend the appointments of the pending appointees, and that he considered their appointments to continue to be valid and that they would continue to serve. So based on that letter and that action by the governor, Ledge Council voted to file a suit asking for the court to enforce the provisions of HB 309, as well as the existing statute, which is Alaska Statute 3905080. And Ledge Council sought a preliminary injunction to stop those appointees from acting for this time in question, which was December 15th through the beginning of this regular session. And the Juneau Superior Court denied Ledge Council's request for a preliminary injunction, but that preliminary injunction was not a ruling on the merits of the case. So the matter proceeded as usual through the Superior Court. And because the issue was really one of substantive legal issues and no disputes of fact, the case went directly into summary judgment briefing. And the parties did extensive briefing. And on February 18th, Judge Pallenberg issued a summary judgment opinion in favor of Ledge Counsel, holding that the governor's appointees did in fact expire and were tantamount to declination on December 15th, 2020, and that the governor lacked the legal authority to extend those appointments either under Article 3, Sections 25, 26, or 27. And so based on that summary judgment order, we had a final judgment that was entered in favor of the legislature on February 25th, 2021. And shortly thereafter, the governor filed a notice of appeal in the Alaska Supreme Court. So the matter is still under litigation. It's currently being briefed in the Alaska Supreme Court, and we're expected to have a decision on somewhere around the beginning to middle of April. And one of the key issues or questions that has come up with respect to the litigation is what impact does the lawsuit or the decision have on the legislature's ability to consider the governor's appointees this session that were appointed this session. And so as part of the litigation that was undertaken last year that's still ongoing, there has never been a dispute that under Alaska Statute 3905080, paragraph 3, which says that a person who is refused the governor is prohibited from reappointing the same person in the interim between regular sessions. And so there's never been a dispute that the governor had the power to reappoint anyone who was considered rejected by law through operation of HB 309. It was never disputed that the governor could reappoint those individuals at the beginning of this regular session, which is what in fact, the governor did on January 9th, I think it's the 19th, was the first day of session. He reappointed most of the individuals who had been considered rejected. So there's nothing about the lawsuit that prevents the legislature from continuing through its normal confirmation process. This session, the legislature will operate under the usual procedural statute, 3905080, which governs the procedure of appointments. But that's a general synopsis, and I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Okay. Senator Hughes.
Thank you for that concise summary. Megan, I'm hearing it. Can you mute yourself, Megan?
Yes.
There. Okay. All right, we'll try it now. Okay, we're good. Thank you. So it sounds like January 19th and on, we're good. So we've got this donut hole situation. So I have two questions in regard to that. Is there any way that the legislature could retroactively approve, since we didn't convene here in Juneau, would that be a legal way to take care of this to save public dollars that are now being spent by the legislative branch and the executive branch on a case? And so is there a legislative fix? And then I'm forgetting what my second question is, so I'll just go with that one for now.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm not sure what procedural option might be available to the legislature to retroactively confirm those appointments that were made last session. So I guess I'm not really able, I'm not aware of an option to go back to retroactively ratify or resolve the issue that has now passed. And in terms of the ongoing litigation, the governor's office has filed the appeal in the matter. So unless the parties were able to resolve the issue or the governor withdrew the appeal, that's the reason that we are continuing to litigate the issue.
Yeah, so I'm going to comment that, and then I did remember my second question. I remember we had something similar, and we convened as far as the RPL process, and we ratified the action so that we were sure we were in line with the Constitution. So that's where I was wondering if we could ratify backdate approval. The second question I have, do we have any board or commission that took action during that donut hole period where that action would be then invalid? Is LEDS Legal aware that any board or commission met during that time? It happened to be holiday time, so I'm thinking maybe none of the boards and commissions even met, but I don't know that.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, you're correct. So the legislature does from time to time take action by law and ratify, you know, past events, but with respect to confirmations, I'm not sure that the process that would work for a constitutional mechanism like confirmations, but I'm happy to think about that and get back to you or the committee at a later time. With respect to the second question about actions that might have taken place during this very limited period of question that we're talking about, which you're correct is really, I believe, December 15th through, you know, January 19th. There were several boards, I believe, that did meet. I have not independently done the research to go through all of the boards and commissions to verify which met, but I do recall, and again, this is just kind of off the top of my head, but I believe the alcohol board met, and there was a few that may have met, and the Superior Court decision, however, did not render a decision on the specific actions that board members might have taken during that period of time. So if anyone were to challenge the actions of the appointees that are affected, that would have to be a separate and independent legal challenge.
Thank you.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wallace. If you, I just kind of jotted down my notes here on what happened in a timeline. If you could just kind of confirm that my thinking is correct here. So the original statutes on confirming board appointments indicated the legislature shall meet in joint session. HB 309 basically had the same language, said they shall meet, but it also gave an out to the legislature about what would happen if they left early, or what would happen if they didn't meet, I should say. So the legislature then left early before they had a joint session. The legislature was effectively afraid of reconvening due to COVID. The legislature didn't pass remote operations legislation before they left. They didn't call themselves into special session. And then the governor could have called the legislature into special session and then didn't. Is that all correct?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, you're correct. The legislature did not reconvene after it adjourned last session. to take up confirmations or any other legislation.
Okay. Another question, if I could. So theoretically, then, could a legislature, a future legislature, whether it's this one or sometime down the road, that wanted to hamstring a governor, simply not hold a joint session for confirmations, and then the entire list of confirmations up from the governor would then be immediately disqualified?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I wouldn't want to speculate. The operable provision that governs the procedure for appointments, 3905080, which states in current law and has been in law in substantive form since 1964, states that the failure of the legislature to act, confirm, or decline results in an appointment being tantamount to declination. So this is a long-standing procedural statute. The legislature, it's my understanding, has never used or exercised that statute in a way to fail to decline a large number of appointments. The exception of last year was largely as a result of the public health situation.
Okay. Just a comment, if I may, Madam Chair, that Ms. Wallace, this isn't to you, this is just in general. When I was in high school, I had a couple of people tell me I should go into law, and situations like this are part of the reason I didn't, is because what I'm looking at here is a case where we may have a party that is legally in the right, but there doesn't really appear to be a party that is morally in the right. It seems like we're in some ways giving the legislature a power that it shouldn't have, and in some ways allowing somebody to duck their duty, and I'm uncomfortable with that. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is a comment, mostly some of Senator Meyer's questions, because I actually had them jotted. But he asked questions, Megan answered, and I just want to throw it out for the public record, because I do think it's important. And as folks will remember, we did have a remote operations bill that was shut down by previous leadership in the Senate, and then the House didn't vote on it, so we would have had the option to do some of these things, and that was taken away from us, even though many of the legislators in the previous session did want to do that for various reasons. We're still working on it now. We have another Senate version. We're waiting on the House again to approve something so we can actually do this for those that might be out of the building or whatever happens. So hopefully they will take that up soon so that we will not be prevented from doing our duties as we need to. Well, number one. And the second thing I thought was important for the record, as you highlighted, the governor did not call a session and could have, but chose not to for whatever his reasons are, and that's up to him to explain. However, it's also important to note that the previous leadership was telling people that they could not get a consensus to call their own special session. And I can tell you for a fact that there was a number of us that were never asked that question. So I would say the responsibility falls on both parties for the record, that we could have done something about this and chose not to for whatever people's reasons are. And that is important because the people deserve to have these things done, and we did not do that. And I hope with that, Senator Myers, for the record moving forward, that we will take up these things so that we are not preventing ourselves from doing the people's work, because we did. And that falls on our shoulders. So thank you, Madam Chair, for that. I just thought we should get that on the record.
Senator Hughes, and then I'm going to finally make a comment.
Yes, and I will agree with Senator Schauer, and that's one of the reasons why I think we ought to, when we work on the disaster statutes, that we ought to put something that would trigger remote operations that would suspend the uniform rule, so we could do that when we're in a disaster situation. And I'm going to Monday morning quarterback here a bit, Megan. Could the governor, looking back at the situation, what happened, could the governor have advised the boards and commissions not to meet during those times and not reappointed them and just essentially left them vacant? Or if he would have done that, would he have hamstrung the boards and commissions from meeting their statutory obligations to do work from that during that period?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's a difficult question for me to answer, to the extent that I don't have specific information as to what issues or which matters some of those boards may have had before them at the time in question. Certainly, it seems as though an alternative or an option for the governor would have been to advise the boards to either not meet or to have appointees who whose appointments may be disputed to not participate in those meetings and then reappoint those persons in the beginning of the next regular session. But that's a little speculative, you know, after the fact. But I think that some of those, yes, are options.
And just follow up briefly on that, so that, that Sarah Chambers might be able to provide that answer. But I just want to add a comment before you go on with your questions, Madam Chair, regarding the time and the dollars that the legislative branch has spent on this, the time and dollars the executive branch has spent on this, and then I realized it's actually time and dollars for the judiciary branch. So, and these are all public dollars. So that's why I would like to see some kind of resolution, some kind of come to agreement. And I was wondering, and maybe you could get an estimate to us later. I don't know if you all track your hours like in the private sector, if the Department of Law tracks its hours, but I would be like an estimate of what is this is costing between the three branches, if that would be possible.
Megan?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we do track our litigation time to some extent. We don't track it precisely minute by minute like some attorneys in private practice might. But in terms of cost, I'm not aware of any extra cost that the litigation has imposed on at least the legislative branch. The litigation with respect that's ongoing has been handled in-house by my office within our regular legislative budget.
Senator Hughes, are you done? Okay. Megan, this is, first of all, just a little heads up to you, but because I have a Monday, Wednesday, Friday afternoon quarterback on my right, and I have a very enthusiastic, hardworking vice chairman on my left, I want to let you know that we're probably going to have a disaster declaration bill. I'm going to ask everybody on the committee. I've been working on it, even was working on it hours this weekend and an hour or two this morning. If you guys could get me your suggestions by Wednesday at noon so I can have them to Megan by 5 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday, that would be great, okay? I'm going to include Senator Schauer, and I will meet afterwards, and we will agree if he wants to incorporate his remote operations that he worked on last year. And I want to thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, for your leadership on that. We would have prevented a whole lot of headache if we would have got that through on the House. I know we got it through on the Senate, but I really, really wanted to thank you. You had a lot of great foresight. And so we may be incorporating that anyway, Megan. You know I've sent you lots of stuff on that, and I just sent you more this morning. So it's a pretty comprehensive bill, and I'd like it to be a Judiciary Committee bill, but if everyone could send me their ideas once again by Wednesday at noon, that would be great. Now I'm going to get back to you, Megan, in regards to the Legislative Council. Legislative Council is meeting this Wednesday. As you know, are you on the agenda?
Through the Madam Chair, not that I'm aware.
Okay. So if I can just put you on the spot just for a minute, my personal opinion in regards to this, which may be the echoes of thousands of people, I'm not sure. But in regards to the disaster extension, it was hard. It was hard because the disaster was all the way through November 15th. Then it was extended, and there was a lot of chaos going on with travel and all that kind of stuff. And so I think meeting, you can blame leadership and all that, which maybe it's their fault. But also there was a lot of confusion regarding the holidays and travel and restrictions and whether we could go, whether we could not. We weren't organized. Anyway, it was pretty wild. So I guess what I'm asking you in regards to this situation. Would you, as the director of legal affairs, recommend a remote operation be added into the disaster declaration?
Through the Madam Chair, that's difficult for me to speculate or to really take a position as to whether I recommend that the legislature adopt permanent remote voting or other remote session, possibilities or protocols. I will say that's certainly a policy call that that legislators and the legislature as a whole needs to make with respect to the ongoing pandemic. The factors that I would say that the legislature needs to consider is the possibility, of a sudden widespread outbreak where members aren't able to meet, or particularly where there might be a problem establishing a quorum. Certainly, if you want to avoid a long recess or the inability to meet, you might make provisions for remote sessions. There, once the COVID pandemic ends, and we certainly are all hopeful that one day we will be out of the current pandemic, there may be future events that the legislature could consider planning for, such as, earthquakes or other major disasters, or even future health related disaster. So again, those are all policy decisions that I can't really specifically recommend that you take, but there's certainly a lot of considerations and for you to consider as this issue moves forward.
Okay, and I'm just going to follow up with that on the media in the room, ADN, and there's lots of stuff on the media, the news, about new strains and all this stuff, and it just seems like I'm not sure when there's going to be an end in regards to this. So I think that it is important, and we're going to bring you back when we get this disaster bill. So just heads up, you guys are going to be helping write the bill. Oh, goodness, did you want to make a quick question? I know he has to leave. I'm sorry. Okay, he has to leave. He told me ahead of time he's got a resolution before Labor and Commerce. So he had another question. I apologize. Megan, I'm going to try to get that in writing to you, okay? He did tell me he needed to step out, and he will be back. But in regards to, I don't know if you can comment, we also did an appeal on this side. I know that's why we had to have this urgent meeting in Ledge Council. And I think we gave the powers, for Hannon. And can you comment on that right now? Because as vice chairman, the highest position that you can get over here in the Senate, I don't know what's going on over there. And so if someone could let me know, I'm going to be asking that question obviously on Wednesday, but whatever you're comfortable putting on the record, it would sure be nice to know.
Yes, Madam Chair. I believe what you're referring to is that Legislative Council held a meeting and delegated authority to the chair to make litigation decisions for our ongoing legal matters that are pending, because matters come up and filings need to be made. And so it wasn't to initiate an appeal or any new litigation. It was just to delegate the authority to work with my office on these ongoing matters.
Okay, so guys, that definitely raises, I thought there was a deadline and it was like potentially just for this situation. Or is this the normal way that you guys work through the Ledge Council, is delegating? Because, as vice chairman, it's almost a co-chairman, it seems like, because of the way that the structure works. I'm trying to figure out why it was so urgent on that day, because we got called urgency at the last minute. We heard a judge needed an opinion, and so we did this, and I don't even know if this is a normal, procedure that happens in Ledge Council. It all came, we literally got like a 30-minute notice before the meeting.
Madam Chair, the Ledge Council meeting was called in response to some very immediate urgent deadlines that had been set in the appeal of the governor's appointee lawsuit. And it is not unusual to delegate to the chair the authority to work, at least with my office, on the appeals or on the matters that are under litigation, which is what Legislative Council had chosen to do when it initiated both the forward funding education suit and the governor's and the litigation with respect to the governor's appointments when it undertook that litigation. But with a new legislature and a new chair, we didn't have that pending authority.
Okay, and so one more time, because this is my first time serving as vice chair, and I don't want the Senate to be left out, and that's why I'm literally trying to make sure that the Senate has its rightful place, and I'll probably bring this up on Wednesday. But I'm trying to figure out, so how many times in the past, you say it's not unusual, I want to know, is this usual and customary? You know, how many times in the past does this happen, or is this constant? Has this always happened that the chair, like in the Senate, if it was in the Senate, and then for 2 years, and then it goes to the House, and also you could go ahead and discuss how the vice chair and chair works if you're comfortable doing that right now, because I just want to look out for the opinions of the Senate, and that's where my motive is here.
I can't really comment on the relationship between the vice chair and the chair, but in my experience, the chair has consistently been delegated the power to handle decisions or make litigation decisions with respect to pending litigation.
Okay, and then my final question would be, how often does litigation happen? And what are the parameters within that? Can they just kind of operate without the Ledge Council, the members of the Ledge Council? I mean, it just seems very unusual. And so, you know, I have not been on Ledge Council for several years. And so I'm just asking you to refresh my memory. And what exactly powers does the chair have in regards to litigation?
With respect to your question, is with respect to Ledge Council's powers on litigation,
and exactly what specifically the chairman got with that motion that I made was given at the last second. So yeah, that's basically what I'm trying. Is that identical to what motions have been, and is this how you said has been happened in the past, and then exactly what powers those are. Just to talk to you, we all have that power. So I guess I'm like trying to figure out exactly what this gave her.
I think it would be, Madam Chair, if you might allow me to, I think that this would probably be a better discussion to have either privately or maybe in at Legislative Council. Just because sometimes these discussions relate to matters involving strategy or things like that. And with our pending matters, I'd be more comfortable discussing this either in private or executive session during a Legislative Council meeting.
Understood, Megan. No problem. I'll be calling you, okay? So thank you very much. And I'm really happy Senator Kale's back. So you're first up now.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for stepping out. Thank you very much for indulging me. I had a resolution up in the Labor and Commerce Committee. And I apologize that I've missed a few minutes of the committee's conversation with Ms. Wallace. I'm inclined to agree that it's never a good thing when the branches end up in court with one another. It suggests that things have probably broken down somewhere. The one benefit that comes, I think, of getting the Supreme Court to clarify this issue finally is that it really sharpens everyone's understanding of what the stakes are in those discussions between and among leadership and governors and exactly what's on the line. The question I had for Ms. Wallace, I read the Superior Court judge's decision, and there was one thing I'm not sure I fully understood. The ruling seemed to dispense pretty handily, and please correct me if I've read this wrong, with the notion that not voting on appointees equals yes. I think the judge only cited two or three places where that's explicitly provided, and everywhere else he could find that's not the case, and he said it was not the case in Alaska. But then the judge seemed to say if not voting on appointees does not equal no, which was one of the governor's sort of fallback holdings, it changed dramatically the legislature's power of confirmation into a, I think he said, the power to remove, and I'm not sure I understood that. Can you help me understand what the judge's ruling meant?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So the issue, or the question as to whether or not voting is, you know, tantamount to yes, or not voting is tantamount to a declination, I don't have the summary judgment opinion in front of me, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, but the Judge Pallenberg's decision upheld the language in HB 309 and 3905080 paragraph 3 that said that the failure to vote was tantamount to declination as provided by law by the legislature. The other option is if the failure to vote was not tantamount to declination, it could have resulted in what is sometimes referred to as tacit confirmation, wherein the legislature doesn't specifically and affirmatively vote to confirm someone, that they just tacitly become confirmed through through inaction. And there was a pre-statehood case, it was the Munson matter, where we had a very early court decision that stated that tacit confirmation is not something that the legislature had provided for, and therefore wasn't a viable solution where the legislature hadn't acted. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I did not mean to put Ms. Wallace on the spot with the detail question. That was an interesting part of the ruling, and I'll perhaps follow up with her for a better understanding. But it seemed to me the judge was saying that the governor might want to be careful not to get his way, or he could lose a lot.
Interesting.
So I'll need a better understanding going forward.
I have no problem. This is judiciary, and I think assertive questions are important. So I don't mind people asking, and I really appreciate Megan being here. I do. I'm going to see if there's any other issues. It doesn't look like Megan at this time. I'm just going to make one comment. I do like checks and balances on branches of government. I think it's very, very important, and I think it helps the peace. So with that, I thank you for what you're doing with this Ledge Council lawsuit, and I look forward to talking to you on Wednesday in Ledge Council. And thank you for being with us, and thanks for all the help you provide on all our bills. I know you're real busy over there. So thank you, Megan. Okay, so
thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to go ahead and put the appointees. We only had one today, but because amendments are so, we only have 45 minutes left. We're going to go ahead and tangle the amendments now. Okay, so Senator Myers, I'm going to just gavel out for 1 minute and talk to you just about make sure everybody has all the amendments in the right order. Okay, so we're just going to be offline for 1 minute. Brief at ease. Okay, we're going to go ahead and move on to SB 90. And this is Senator Myers' bill. And Senator Myers, first of all, I'm going to ask you just to make a few statements about the bill, if you don't mind, and then we're going to move into the amendment process.
Yeah, no problem. So SB 90 was put together in an attempt to rectify a hole in our operations, in a sense, not our as terms of the legislature, but our in terms of the state. It became pretty apparent real quick in the pandemic that we've been through that the people that may want to write their wills also tend to be the people that would be most afraid of going somewhere in person. And as of right now, all wills have to, while you can write a will online, it is not possible to yet notarize it or witness it and make it legal online yet. And so the point of this bill was to fix that hole in our operations and allow somebody to get a will notarized and witnessed through Zoom or some other sort of platform so that we can still verify who somebody is, but at the same time allow us to do it remotely and fill in one of those gaps.
So. Excellent. Okay, so with that, go ahead, Senator.
This is just in general, this would just be helpful. To the sponsor, Senator Myers, did you look into any recommendations by the Uniform Law Commission in regard to this? Because especially when you have people across state lines, I know I worked on a power of attorney bill, and sometimes we don't care for what they might have, or it's not, we need to customize it because of unique situations in Alaska. But I'm just wondering if, because all the states are probably wrestling with the same thing. They have the same problem. Pandemic highlighted it. So I'm just wondering, did you refer to any recommendations by the Uniform Law Commission?
So this bill, as written, was based on model legislation from the Uniform Law Commission. And you are correct. A number of other states are looking into this. I'd have to double check offhand. I'm wanting to say about a dozen have already done this either through legislation or through executive order. And another about 25 or 30 are currently working on legislation, same as we are.
And follow up to that.
Go ahead.
And, you know, I think the members here know that, but for those that might be listening, Uniform Law Commission are attorneys that work in a particular field, and, you know, they're pretty much brainiacs on a certain topic, and so, and they're coming from all the states, and they banter back and forth till they figure out what would work across state lines and what would seem to be acceptable. So it's always a resource worth looking at. So thank you for that.
Okay, and so before we get started on the amendments, I want to tell everybody who's online. We've got Abigail O'Connor online from Homer. We've got Nancy Mead, the General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, Matt Blottmacher with Peak Trust, and Chelsea Ricola, I believe. And please, when you get called on, you can state your name properly if I misstated it. But I just want to make sure everybody knew the resources before we get into the amendments, and then you know who your lifelines are that you probably arranged already ahead of time, Senator Myers. So first of all, we're going to start with B.1, which will be Amendment Number 1. Senator Myers.
All righty. Madam Chair, I move Amendment 1.
Object for purposes of discussion.
All right. So, Madam Chair, this amendment was brought forward because, well, there was a little bit of confusion in regards to the drafting, and then also in response to issue that Senator Keel brought up the last time we discussed this bill, last week or so. And the point here is it's the section regarding holographic wills, and we recognize that this being Alaska, sometimes technology isn't available. Sometimes people handwrite their wills, and our court recognizes those. And we wanted to be able to carry some of that provision over to an electronically witnessed will as well. And the point here is we don't want to allow somebody to simply type out a will on their computer because we can't tell who it came from. But we want to still allow for the handwriting of those wills. And that is where we were trying to clarify some of the language there. So, for example, we wanted to be able to allow somebody to write their will out on paper and then maybe take their phone and take a picture and something along those lines to help preserve the record since papers sometimes get lost or degrade, et cetera. So we wanted to allow for that as a possibility. And so Amendment Number 1 then clarifies the language. Instead of saying that it is
something electronic that is readable as text, we want to include the handwritten portion that may be then in electronic form.
Okay, this is a very simple. I just want to note that Ledge Legal's not online. The Bannister's not online. So at some point we may want to get that person online, but unless if we have questions. But right now this is a pretty simple text, and you're positive that it does what you say it does. Okay, just a sec, Senator Hughes, and then I'll get to you. Okay.
So Senator Myers decided he didn't want to be an attorney. I did too, but it's a little bit in my blood because I've come from a family of them. So I have the same concern about the handwritten, and we wanted to make sure an image or a photograph of the handwritten holographic will would be what would be accepted. When we say which may be an electronic form, I'm still concerned it could be an electronic Word document or an electronic PDF. So I'm just wondering, and you're saying Ledge Legal's not on the line, why we didn't just refer to an image or an image in an electronic form.
Okay, and before anybody answers, during amendment process, I like to relax the rules. The rules say you're supposed to do that, and I don't want all the formality that you guys have to. I'd like to relax it so you guys can directly, so if you guys can just kind of go ahead and talk with one another, just state who you are if there's two men or two women, just for Nancy, okay?
So I guess my question, Madam Chair, would be since we don't have Ledge Legal online, are we sure by saying which may be an electronic form, we're not opening it to Word documents and PDFs online.
And the only thing I'm going to ask is when you ask your question, ask the person directly so then Nancy knows exactly who's talking. So this is directed towards Senator Myers. Senator Myers.
So in the operative text here, in the bill immediately preceding where we're planning on inserting the word, it says in the testator's handwriting. So we are trying to preserve somebody's handwriting here, so that portion is already covered, and we wanted as it is currently in there, it says or readable as text, so it would be handwriting or. This would be handwriting which is readable or which is in electronic form.
Thank you, and that was my mistake, Madam Chair, because I didn't realize the word or had been taken out. Thank you.
Okay, and then can you recognize your staff too?
Yeah.
Because I know they're working on the bill.
So I've got my staff, Josiah Nash, here, if we've got who's been doing the research on this one, in case we have questions as well.
Excellent. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. you will see if you look ahead, skip ahead, that I have an amendment that was going to go all the way the other direction. The concern I have is if as amended, this says handwriting may be in electronic form, it seems to me that it would allow a font made from an individual's handwriting, which I can now pay a designer a couple of hundred bucks to do, pretty cheap with the assets of a life on the line. And in future, maybe even cheaper as machine learning algorithms can learn to take, you know, all the ligatures and where the letters connect up high and down low, won't be long before we're able to write a letter in great grandfather's script. And so I'm concerned. Is there anything in the language, the way the amendment has it, that would prevent someone from typing in a handwriting font made from an individual's own handwriting?
I'm going to let you guys. And you're welcome to have your staff come up here if you want to, Senator Myers. That's your choice. I just think it's better if they're at the table in case you want to direct a question to them, then we're ready. But if you guys, again, I'm going to relax. Just state who the question is directed to. In this case, it's Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam. So, Senator Keel, as of right now, it would not. I would say that is still a possibility that could be challenged on the back end once the will is being executed. One thing that's been noted as far as fonts go that you mentioned is that a font would reproduce things exactly, and a person's handwriting is never exact. I comment to people all the time that my signature is never twice the same, which whether that makes it more easier or harder to forge, I don't know. But a person's handwriting is never completely the same, so if we did need to challenge it on that grounds, I believe that a handwriting expert would still be able to do so, and we might be able to get input on that one from some of our invited testimony if necessary.
And you know who's on here, right?
Yeah. If I could ask my staff, Josiah Nash, who specifically we should be asking on that one.
Abigail might be able to.
Okay. Okay. Identify yourself for the record.
Through Chair Josiah Nash for record. Yes, Senator Myers. Abigail O'Connor might be able to answer that question.
Okay.
Okay, excellent. Glad we're using the lifelines on the line. I know it must be tough for you guys sitting on the line sometimes. I'm sure you want to talk, and I don't know how to allow it unless someone calls on you. But anyway, if you guys' line's unmuted and you really have something to say, I don't mind you speaking up a little bit. Amendment process is where the fat's put in, the spice is put on, and the debate is feisty at times. And so I really think amendment time is a very important to relax the rules and let people just really, really ask these. And I think it's an excellent question, to be honest with you. I do. So, Abigail O'Connor, please step in and see if you can provide us some insight.
Through the chair, thank you. This is Abigail O'Connor. I'm an estate planning attorney, primarily in Anchorage, although I split my time between Anchorage and Homer. I'm also one of the attorneys who worked on drafting the language for this bill. Let me just give a little background for the holographic and will portion of this and what we had envisioned. The idea is right now I can take out a notebook, piece of notebook paper, and with my pen I can scratch out, you know, last will and testament of Abigail O'Connor. I leave everything to my husband, and that would work, right? And sign it, and that would work. What we had envisioned is, you know, I'm sitting here. I take all of my notes on an electronic device called a Remarkable, and we said, well, why not? Why can't I just, in my handwriting, why does it have to be on paper? Why can't it be on a tablet with my stylus? That's what the idea of this was. You know, in terms of the Senator Keel's concern over the handwriting and a font, I think that is a valid concern. You know, can it happen? Maybe as technology gets better. I think we're going to have that problem in a lot of areas, not just holographic wills. But Senator Myers is absolutely correct, and that is that, you know, wills are offered in probate. They are they're offered. They can be challenged. And if they are challenged, perhaps this would be the issue, is this the person's handwriting or was it a computer-generated document? And for that, we'd have a handwriting expert. But that issue already can exist with a holographic will. We already have that issue with a holographic will. It's one of the reasons we don't love holographic wills, is because if you don't have witnesses, how do you know this was the person writing the document? How do you know they weren't writing it at gunpoint? So the way I see this, at least, is yes, it might add one more aspect that can be challenged, but this is already a challenging type of will, but our law allows it.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate the insight. I agree wholeheartedly. Holographic wills are challenging and risky. The core of the bill is good. It's largely future-proofing our wills statutes. I think we may need to future-proof this particular piece of future-proofing, and so I'm not comfortable with this amendment.
Okay, and I'll be honest, I'm doubtful myself, you know, and I did want to say to relax the rules, like you guys know I always do during the amendment process, we've unmuted all the lines. So if Nancy or Matt or Chelsea, I know it gets a little messier if you unmute all the lines, but I think it's important if one of you guys have an expertise, because I actually don't know what way I'm going to vote on this amendment right now. So is anybody online want to jump in?
This is Abigail O'Connor. I'll add for Chelsea, who's on the line, and Chelsea and I work together on this. Chelsea raised the idea, she's texting with me, about adding a definition of handwriting. What I would propose is if you are uncomfortable with the amendment, that we take a little bit more time and try to see if we can develop some additional definition or some additional language that would make everybody comfortable, that would still allow the holographic portion to be updated along with everything else.
Well, just to let the committee know, I don't like to put bills out the same day they're amended, and so we have a little bit of more time, okay? It may be Wednesday getting this out, and if we have just a technical fix on an amendment or two, because my plan was to hopefully get it out on Wednesday, but I don't mind waiting. If you guys want to, if someone wants to make a motion to table this, I'm fine with that. Senator Hughes?
I have a question, and just for the sponsor and those online, and to Senator Keel, it might address the concern. You could also, because technology may advance where what Senator Keel described would be a come up problem, is you could sunset this so you could revisit it if the technology did advance to that degree. So that, I'm just throwing that, if you're going to be working on a way to fix this, just throw that out as a possible idea.
I need the will of the committee, either Senator Keel, Senator Myers. I need some direction. What would you guys would like to do with this amendment?
For myself, what I'd prefer to do is pass the amendment and then possibly bring up another amendment to you on Wednesday in order to fix some of these concerns.
Senator Keel?
I'm probably going to oppose the amendment, but I'm more than happy to continue working on the.
Because I'm the one that has the objection right now, and so I'm trying to figure out. How about, is anyone else in the committee want to weigh in, Senator Shaw?
I would just, Madam Chair, just say that, you know, from an AI perspective, because that's where we're headed with things. You are, not to go down this rabbit hole, but in regards to the concerns that are brought up, we are reaching a point where AI is talking to AI, and the ability to mimic somebody's language by just showing them a picture of it and allowing the AI to actually mimic a person, we're there. So while it may not be commonplace or may not be out in the commercial industry to be able to do some of the concerns, something that would tighten this the future to the future, because we don't know what Back to the Future looks like yet, but I will tell you that AI has advanced to a point that it is mimicking people very well. So being able to say, artificial intelligence, sorry, I should have said that. I appreciate the correction. The ability to mimic somebody's language or how they write is already been proven that that can be done. And that, when you say like, oh, it's got a script and it's never the same, they can introduce that very easily. So I would only add that if there is concern, Madam Chair, we probably should consider either tabling or making a change to it or whatever. But I would make a very clear argument, and I could provide experts to tell you that a computer can fool you now. Just FYI. So,
Senator Hughes.
So that artificial intelligence, if it already could do that, it could do that on the what we would think is the original paper copy. So what we're trying to do here is at least get rid of the chance of a Word document or a PDF. So your ability to mimic, if it does truly exist, as Senator Shower indicated, that's somewhat unrelated to this, because we're talking about the original document. So either I handwrite it or I'm a bad actor and I produce one with a computer. That's the original. So what we're talking about here is you can have an image of that. So you'd have to go back to the original and determine whether artificial intelligence played a role. So for that reason, I'm okay supporting this at this point today with the sponsor of the amendment.
Okay. I'm going to put Chelsea on the line. Can you just step in here? This is always a difficult process, the amendment process. Provide any clarity or insight?
Thank you so much, and I apologize. My voice is a little scratchy. I spent yesterday yelling at my dog. She was chasing a doll sheep, so sorry.
Only in Alaska.
Right. So I would point out, and I think it's good, Madam Chair, to maybe have this to think on.
Oops, I'm sorry. You've got to identify yourself, Chelsea, and you can say your last name properly.
Yes, certainly. So my last name is Ricola, Chelsea Ricola. I'm an estate planning attorney here in Anchorage. I work at Foley & Pearson. I'm a shareholder. Interestingly, I've actually worked on legislation to try to catch wills up to the current day before the RUFCOTA, Revised Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, was based on model legislation that I drafted in law school and was picked up by the ULC. So I do think it's important to stay on top of this kind of stuff, even though it's impossible. Along those lines, I mean, this is a problem that has already had to be addressed by a court in another state. I wish I had the site handy. I do not. But there was a court case where a man drafted his will and signed it using a stylus on a Samsung Galaxy phone. And the court did determine that that was a valid will for the purposes of the state. And that's going to keep happening, and I do certainly recognize it. Future-proofing to the extent it is possible is preferred, but I don't know that there is a silver bullet for every facet of this, and I do think that one of the reasons that we are bringing this legislation forth is to increase accessibility to estate planning, especially in our state where people are located so remotely that they might not have access to a lawyer or witnesses or notaries. That's just my two cents.
Okay, so Chelsea, the Senator Reinbold. So what the problem here is we have two yeses and two noes, and I'm the split vote, I think, and that's why I'm trying to figure out how important is this. I mean, and would you recommend it to appease the committee if we table this and rework it? Because that's always where my default is don't pass something unless you really understand it to a pretty high level. So anyway, that's what I'm leaning on. But just convince me otherwise.
Yeah, well, in my opinion, whatever it takes to get EWIL's legislation passed and preferably to recognize a holographic will, just like our regular statute recognizes holographic wills on paper, would make sense. And I would defer to Abigail O'Connor since she's the chair of the drafting committee. I'm just one of her minions on the drafting committee, albeit a very involved one. But I would defer to Abby on that.
Abby? Again, just state your name when you talk, because there's a lot of us women talking right now. It really helps a wonderful Nancy who's trying to record all this. And thank you, Nancy, by the way. So, Abby?
Thank you, Chairwoman. This is Abigail O'Connor. The language we came up with, which is this, comma, which may be in electronic form, at the time was the best that we could come up with to be broad enough to capture what we saw as the goal. We couldn't think of anything better. In terms of trying to propose something else, I the reason I brought it up earlier is I'm happy to go back and try to think of something else. I don't know if we will. Can we come up with a handwriting definition? I don't know. Sometimes we're in trying to solve one problem, we create three more, and we might end up in that situation with this. I do appreciate the concern, but as I mentioned, already with holographic wills, which in my experience are not all that common. I have currently one active case involving a holographic will. So I don't think they're all that common. Most of the time, people have them witnessed or go to an attorney or something else. So I don't see this as a huge and common problem, at least currently. We can always reexamine it later with AI coming and our artificial intelligence and really wreaking havoc on this. But the image language that was proposed earlier and was talked about, the image of a handwritten will, I don't know if that's going to capture it, because does that mean I can write it with my stylus? What does that mean to be an image? Does it have to be created and then you take an image of it? And so I'm not sure that's going to capture what we were trying to capture. So I support it as written. We came up with it, but I don't know if that helps, Madam Chair. Hopefully.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, so we got 2 minutes, you guys. I'm gonna probably, because we got three more amendments. So I'm gonna give a minute or so to each one of these two and see if you can come up with language. And Vice Chairman Schauer.
Not sure I'm gonna help with that, Madam Chair. But I just was wondering, to the bill sponsor or those experts online. We track packages, Amazon, FedEx, UPS, others, they track them to the nth degree where they are, what they're doing. They authenticate them. They can have signatures on the other end to validate. And while that's a little bit different, we're talking multi-factor authentication. Is there something related to this bill where we can do that, where we might be able to have that type of tracking and or multi-factor authentication, which would solve this problem into the future, for now at least? So just a thought.
That's a good idea. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's you'll crack these open and you find out how deep the rabbit hole goes.
this one's deep.
um, I do think that you know, those who probably have access to the multi-factor authentication tracking systems are liable to have access to a lawyer or at least witnesses, and so the issue that holographic wills address, and not every state allows them at all, but they address, you know, Senator Hughes' example of, you know, the person out in the trapper cabin alone being able to write a will, and that's valuable. But they are prone to, subject to risk. They're risky, and so I guess I would think we're best served by reserving holographic wills to actual handwriting. So if there's, you know, if we get into the disputes and the debates and the handwriting experts, you'd say, oh, that was done on a printer. You know, forget it, it's out. Then you have a different situation. But you know, the risk of fraud is pretty high with something nobody witnesses.
Senator Hughes. Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, we're concerned about the advancement of what artificial intelligence will do, and I'm thinking more and more schools aren't even teaching handwriting, so in a number of decades, someone might not even be able to handwrite a will, and they would be having to do a typed-up one and done in a more traditional way. So just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah, it's a darn shame they're not teaching handwriting. That's all I can say. That's a shame. Anyway, Sir Myers, yay, it's back in your ball.
Just
back in your court.
Just a quick wrap up on this amendment. I know we need to move on, but if we don't pass this amendment, it actually leaves the bill in a worse shape than what we're talking about here, because we're talking about whether or not to allow it at all. And if we wanted to fix that, we'd have to pull out an entire section. If we don't pass this amendment, what we'll actually allow for is, as Senator Hughes mentioned, typing out a Word document. And so at a minimum, I think we need to fix that problem. I understand the concerns of the committee, and I think that's something that we need to think about moving forward. But it's one of these situations where we can either pass it and it's not great, or we can not pass it and it's worse.
I have a later amendment for that.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to remove my objection, and then I know, I understand. Okay, I'm removing my objection.
I'll object.
Okay, Senator Keel is objecting. You get, because whoever gets the final word, so go ahead and speak your final word of why.
I think I've
beat you it. Done it?
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, so we're gonna go ahead and vote at this time. She's putting me in a pickle, but go ahead.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
Yes.
Senator
Reinfeldt. Yes. Reluctantly. But you know what? I really want to say, Senator Kill, you brought up some really important things, and I'm going to ask you two to get together. And this is before this bill is going out of here. We're talking about this again. Okay? All right. Okay. With that, that passes. Amendment number one passes 4-1. We're going to move on. B.2 is amendment number two. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number two.
Object for the discussion.
All right. So amendment number two, again, this was drafted based on some model legislation that other states are also using as well. And the basic premise in the bill as currently written is to allow somebody to electronically deposit a copy of a will with a court. And you don't have to deposit your will with the court. It is relatively common practice. It's basically just, this is the safest place that we can think of, since it has to go there eventually anyway. So the idea was to allow you to deposit it electronically. Well, after discussing with the court system, what we discovered is that the court system is not set up for electronic submission of any document. Wills, evidence in a criminal case, anything. And so in order for allowing an electronic submission of a will, we would end up with a $30 million fiscal note to give them all the computers that they need. And we're trying to avoid that. So instead, we're saying that you may, instead of filing your will electronically with the court, you may get your will written electronically, but then you have to file a paper copy, because okay, that's what they're set up to allow right now.
Excellent. Do you mind if I call on Nancy?
No, please.
Nancy, thank you. You're very patient today. We appreciate it. If you want to comment on either amendment number one, I'll allow you a little bit of flexibility, and, of course, amendment number two, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I actually don't have any comments on Amendment 1 and will defer to the experts who already spoke to that issue. With respect to Amendment 2, I don't have the words in front of me, but I did speak with the sponsor's office, who was very receptive to my remarks. As he explained, we just don't have the ability to accept an electronic will and store it in any sort of electronic form. But people can do the certification of the will copy provided for earlier in the bill and file such a thing with the court, and we would store that for safekeeping.
Excellent, Nancy. Thank you very much. With that, is there any other questions on this one? I think this one's much easier. With that, I'm removing my objection. Okay, amendment number 2 passes unanimously. With that, we're now on B.5. This is a considered amendment number 3. Senator Keel.
Madam Chair, given the outcome with 1, I will not offer amendment 3.
Are you sure you don't want to offer any discussion?
This is the reverse direction of amendment number 1, and so I think it would not be a productive use of our time. We've addressed this one.
But your opinion is very valuable. You know that. Okay, so thank you very much. With that, are you officially withdrawing amendment number 3?
Amendment 3, yes. I have.
Okay, so amendment number 3 is now withdrawn. We're moving on to B.6, which is officially amendment number 4. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment 4.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So amendment 4 has to do with the revocatory acts. So these are where you revoke a will by action, instead of by creating a new will and signing with witnesses and the whole kit and caboodle. So the classic revocatory act would be lighting it on fire or tearing it in half. With electronic wills, it's a little bit of a different situation. People keep so many different copies of electronic files. What does it mean if you deleted some copies and not other copies? What happens? How do we know whether your intent was to revoke? So what Amendment 4 does is it puts in place a higher standard to prove the testator's intent, the will writer's intent, to revoke an electronic will. It doesn't spell out the details of this. The great example was for electronic online services, where you have to click 3 different times and confirm that, yes, indeed, you mean to revoke the whole will. That, I think, would so that the intent in the amendment – sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. The intent in the amendment would be that you need clear and convincing evidence instead of the usual preponderance of the evidence. So it's just one step up in evidence standard. And so that will be a little more protective when you have, umpteen copies of electronic wills floating around. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we're going to take questions, but I always like to get the sponsor of the bills first, if possible, and then know that all the lines are unmuted as well, so there's still several people online, including Marge, and I'm sorry, Marge, I can't say your last name. Sponking, is that correct? With ARP?
Marge Sponking.
Okay, thank you. I just want to note that you've been on since 2:21. With that, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually agree with Senator Keel on this one. When we did the initial hearing on this bill, he brought up the point that deleting can be a little problematic in terms of intention. One can have you don't want somebody to say, well, the cat ran across my keyboard and deleted my will, and therefore it doesn't apply anymore. So I am fully in support of this amendment.
Excellent. Senator Hughes?
And I'll just add to that, we've all accidentally deleted things, and we wouldn't want that to be the case. But my question, Madam Chair, is to see if maybe Abigail O'Connor could weigh in as far as whether, especially the language, must be clear and convincing. Is that going to be a problem, or does she agree that's a good solution for this?
Abigail, did you understand the question?
So, Madam Chair, this is Abigail O'Connor, and I apologize, but I am not able to see the amendments online, so I have not had the privilege of reviewing this particular amendment. What I understand is that the language adds a clear and convincing evidence requirement. Is that only with respect to deleting?
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the language would be on page 6 of the bill dealing with revocatory acts. So for revocatory acts, if it's an electronic will, well, let me grab the language here. If the revocatory act is performed on an electronic will, the evidence to show the testator's intent and purpose must be clear and convincing.
We're going to take just a very brief at ease. Okay, I think we're good, and I'll read it out loud. It says, if the revocatory act is performed on an electronic will, the evidence shown to the testator's intent and purpose must be clear and convincing. And as Senator Keel said, it's one step up in regards to the burden of proof.
And Madam Chair?
Abigail, do you have it? I just read it to you, but it's just one, basically one and a half lines.
She should have just received it by email.
Yeah. We sent it to you.
Madam Chair, this is Abigail O'Connor. I just received it by email. And Chelsea Rickle and I are texting over this, and immediate reaction would be that this may already apply, maybe in practice, because if you're trying to establish a copy of a will, which basically would be what would have happened. So if somebody deleted it, I'm just walking this through. If someone deleted it, and yet, you know, that my mom accidentally deleted her electronic will, and I have a copy, and I'm trying to bring a copy in and establish it, that already has to be, it's a copy of a will, has to already be by clear and convincing evidence. And perhaps the answer is, without talking to all my colleagues on this, that if we're going to make clear and convincing evidence, the express requirement in the statute for deleting, that perhaps it should just apply to all of the revocatory acts for paper wills and electronic wills. One of the things, I'll give you a little more background. One of the things we're trying to avoid is creating different standards for electronic wills and paper wills. I'll give you the example in the certification of will copy. We are not applying that certification process only to electronic wills. The concern was, well, now we're going to have two different standards. So I would be concerned about having two different standards. I don't see, I can't see any downsides, or I have no objection to requiring clear and convincing for burning, tearing, canceling, obliterating, deleting, or destroying the will for all wills, as long as it applied to all wills, not just electronic wills.
Thank you. That actually was extremely helpful. I would like Senator Myers to weigh in, and then I want to see if Keel, if that's your intent.
That's a Ms. O'Connor makes a good point there, and I'd like to hear from Senator Keel first, but I think I may put a conceptual amendment on the amendment, if so.
Senator Kiel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it, you know, it hadn't been my original thought, but as I'm listening, you know, revocatory acts are also, they're not as problematic as holographic wills, but they're also a little problematic. The best thing to do if you want to revoke a will is to do it in writing and to replace it with a will, right? And so you got witnesses, everybody knows, it's easy. But we do allow these revocatory acts, which could leave you with no will. You know, that's, the more I think about it, I'm trying to remember the comments from the Uniform Law Commission proceedings on this, and I actually think that Ms. O'Connor's suggestion makes a lot of sense.
Okay, with that, Senator Myers.
So I would like to offer a conceptual amendment to this amendment to simply remove the words "on an electronic will," so that then it would apply to all wills.
Okay, this is when it gets messy. Senator Kiel.
That's right. I think that's excellent. Just revocatory acts on all wills? Not all revocations, but specifically acts.
If the revocatory act is performed, let's see. So if we did what I'm suggesting, which does somebody need to object?
I'll object for purposes of
justice. All right. So if we did what I'm suggesting, then it would read, if the revocatory act is performed, the evidence to show the testator's intent and purpose must be clear and convincing.
Okay, I definitely want a lawyer to weigh in. Let's have Abigail weigh in. Do you agree with that, Abigail?
This is Abigail O'Connor. What about instead of adding the language at the end, we go into, this would be on line 3 of page 6. So after the word intent, we add proved by clear and convincing evidence, because it's the intent that we're trying to prove, and then we wouldn't need this sentence at the end.
Okay, we're going to need you to do that one more time, and because we've got two motions now on the table, so do you want to withdraw yours just temporarily so she can work on hers? It's up to you, but there's two competing motions.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and withdraw it then.
Okay, so we're back to the amendment itself, just so we can keep the record straight. It's B.6, Senator Kiel.
Clarity and ease, Madam Chair. I'd like to withdraw Amendment 4 and offer a conceptual Amendment 5. And the conceptual
Wait, we've got to do one thing at a time, because we just withdrew an amendment to an amendment, and now we're withdrawing the whole amendment. So you're throwing me for a curve here. Okay, so hold on. Okay, Senator Kiel, wait. Does the body agree? I guess it's your amendment. So I guess Amendment number 4 is officially withdrawn right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I may.
Okay, Senator Kiel, now the spice is going in the sausage.
I think this will work very well. I'd like to offer a conceptual Amendment 5 make the into Section 8 of the bill, so that the showing intent for revocatory acts must be shown by a clear and convincing standard, and we'll have Legislative Legal Services make that language perfect.
I understand that. Abigail, does that sound reasonable to you?
Madam Chair, it's Abigail O'Connor. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, so with that, Senator Kiel, I'm going to put the burden on you to make sure it's drafted. We're going to bring this back. You guys know what your assignments are now for the bill. We're going
to
bring this.
We haven't objected to 5, so has it passed?
Did you actually move it? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he did. So I didn't object. I don't think anybody did object. So I'm saying that everybody agrees that conceptual amendment number 5. If you guys want me to. Hearing no objection, we're going to have that conceptual amendment, and we'll have it drafted. Number 5 at this time passes, but we're gonna still look at it carefully. Okay, on Wednesday. Okay, thank you guys, and thank you those online that were part of the sausage making amendment process. It's definitely the most challenging of all of what we do in regards to the legislation. It's super important though to get people to weigh in regards to that.
So what we are going to do now, we always have to change the agenda just a little bit. Wednesday we will be taking up more governor's appointees, and my staff will get those to you. We will also continue this bill on Wednesday, and I'm hoping we get it out. I didn't. There's a couple of you guys that are flying back to your district. I think you two on Friday potentially for the MATSU. And so right now Friday's to be announced. So I'm just I have it booked, but I just want you guys to know it might be a little bit up in the air right now. With that, we're going to go ahead and gavel out right at 2:59 p.m. Thank you.